Do you think, speaking of balance, that writing about a frog, a mammoth, a dino, and the scariest monster in the world balances well the seriousness of the financial writing that you do as well?
I don't know. It certainly works for me.
But, you know, I think there's a lot of wisdom in all those tales that we tell kids, because when you really think about the lessons in a lot of those stories are as relevant to kids as they are to adults. We just forget them. You know, stories of greed and envy and all the other ones that, you know, parables and tales and fables that we've read or heard as kids, they kind of repeat in the adult life, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the longer I've been writing about investing, the more I see it as boiling down to these very, you know, basic urges, which, you know, emotion overtakes intellect in almost all circumstances, unless you have a very clear structure in place to kind of, you know, jolt you back to, you know, the rational you and focus on what, you kind of know you should be doing intellectually rather than what you really hugely want to do. One of the basis of how I manage it is through a rebalancing process. And rebalancing, you're essentially buying pain and, you know, selling the stuff which has done well, which makes you feel good. And just doing something as simple as that, I find, you know, traumatic almost.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question. What it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, Search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. What a wonderful way to kick off the new year with Al G. Hall. Happy New Year, all my dear listeners. So grateful to see you here with my guests in a brand new year. Today, it's one of those conversations that put a big smile on my face. Al G. writes about investing, but he's also an author and illustrator of children's books. We have some laughs today about some very serious and less serious matters. Al G. Hall is an award-winning financial journalist and an author of 4 Ways to Beat the Market, a practical guide to stock screening strategies to help you pick winning shares. For over a decade, Al G. followed several market-beating screening strategies in his weekly column for Investors Chronicle, Financial Times' own leading British investment magazine. Since 2022, Al G. has been the investment editor of CityWire Elite Companies, where he has helped develop CityWire's stock rating system based on the level of backing shares have from the world's best performing portfolio managers. He's also the author and illustrator of 11 children's picture books. We start the conversation with a very personal story that sheds more light on Al G.'s relationship with money and curiosity about investing. I'm a big proponent of using screening in the investment process. I've tested and backtested a variety of screens throughout my 2-decade-long career. Algy takes on a number of stock screens in his book, Four Ways to Beat the Market. The book came out in 2023, and I believe it belongs among the classics in the genre. Together with James O'Shaughnessy's What Works on Wall Street and Ken Fisher's 1984 book, Super Stocks, and of course, Joel Greenblatt's The Little Book That Beats the Market. My guest explains how stock screens give investors an edge. One of my biggest revelations over the years has been the power of filters. And I noticed that more experienced and more seasoned investors use very deliberate filters, deciding what kind of stocks, news, and even people make it into their portfolios, days, and lives. We talk about quality stocks, contrarian value investing, dividend stock approach, and momentum investing. As serious as the topics might be today, Algy shares with me his passion for children's books and tells the story of the scariest monster in the world. Stay tuned until the end to hear how stories and fairy tales that we heard as kids might have been hiding lessons, advice, and wisdom that we so desperately need as adults. I had so much fun recording with Algy, and I trust you'll enjoy the next hour with us as well. Please help me welcome Algy Hall. Nice to see you.
Hi, very well, and good to be talking.
Well, you know that I'm a big fan of your book. I came across your book a few months ago, and I was reading it, rereading it carefully the last few weeks, and it's a very special book. It was very accessible, very easy to follow. It's called Four Ways to Beat the Market, a practical guide to stock screening strategies to help you pick winning shares. And as I mentioned to you, and we'll talk more about it, I think you have a way of explaining some very complicated topics and intimidating ideas, like financial statements to begin with, in a way that I think is very accessible, relatable to somebody that has little or no experience. So I really appreciated that. But before we talk about your book, I want to ask you about your childhood and upbringing and how that time you think influenced your career. And at some point, maybe right away, we will talk about other books that you've written that are not about the stock market, but I'll just say it. One of them is about the scariest monster in the world. So share as much as you want.
Yes, no. It's a really interesting question. It's actually one that I've kind of thought about quite a lot, because my job, it's best to start by explaining about my job a bit, because my job is very weird in some ways. I'm a financial journalist, and I've spent about 25 years, I guess, mainly writing about equities and investment cases and things like that. I don't know if it's the same in the US, but in the UK at least, if you want to work for a reputable publication, you're not allowed to actually invest in anything you write about. So it's kind of, slightly monk-like existence, which actually I think surprises a lot of people. But I think anyone who knows about the biases which are created through share ownership will appreciate that it's actually probably very important for anyone who's wants to give good impartial views on businesses and their shares. It's important for them to actually stay away from having a financial interest in what they're writing about. But obviously this is odd to be kind of really interested in this topic but not involved. And I suppose there are possibly two things from my childhood which kind of help explain that. One is kind of like, financially what happened to my family when I was young. I think I know you're very interested in intergenerational wealth. And I think both my parents were kind of at the end of that line when the kind of money's run out. But they kind of, had the expectations that you probably have when you're very well off. And they were, I'd say they were more, middle class, but they were sending me and my siblings to, expensive schools and, things like that. And then two things happened, which one was children and the other was recession. And on the children front, I've got an elder sister, and then there's me. And then my parents went to have a third child and they had quadruplets. Which so four children all coming along at once, which is a fairly major thing for family finances to absorb. And then there was a recession, a huge recession at the end of the 80s and the early 90s in the residential property market. My dad's business was in residential property property. And basically, his business went to the wall. We ended up losing the house, and we ended up living with my with my grandparents in the depths of the countryside in the south of England. So, I mean, you know, we're lucky to have somewhere where we ended up. But I think that experience really had a very deep impact on my attitudes towards money and risk. And really, you know, what's interesting is that it's very contradictory, because on the one hand, I learned the importance of money in terms of the impact that a sudden change in wealth can have on the life of a family. And I think it made me deeply conservative financially in some mm-hmm. respects. But also, you know, it was in many ways, I saw my dad like really suffer from what happened. But I absolutely loved what happened to my life. I kind of, I wasn't very happy with this kind of slightly gilded lifestyle that I'd been born into, and you know, this the really very elite school I'd been sent to. And I escaped all that, and I kind of ended up thriving, you know, socially and academically as a result, which is kind of the opposite, I think, of what you'd predict. And mm-hmm. It made me think, you know, there's lots to life which is going to be a lot more important to me than the amount of money I make. And perhaps that kind of brings us on slightly to the scariest monster that you were referring to. Because I've also, throughout my life, as soon as I was able to pick up a pencil, I've been obsessed with drawing. And uh-huh. and it means I had this huge ambition to be an illustrator, even though I studied economics at university, and you know, it was very much academically I was quite broad ranging. And but I finished university with a degree in something completely unrelated to illustration, but desperately wanted to be an illustrator. And I've ended up having several books, I think 12 books published, children's picture books, which have been a huge joy to me. But if you want to have a kind of, you know, dual career, journalism is actually quite good for that, because you don't have to necessarily work, you know, all hours, and you can, you know, quite easily work, you know, 4 days and 3 days a week, as I have done for parts of my career, and you know, get on with other things outside it. So I think you know, all those factors together made journalism, financial journalism, a really interesting job mm-hmm. for me, and made me not mind the fact that, you know, I'm not actually allowed to you know, participate in what I'm writing about, even though that can feel deeply frustrating sometimes when you you know, when you kind of see this amazing company which is being underappreciated, and you're writing about it for people, and you know, you're not able to, you know, even take the slightest punt on it yourself.
But you can invest, right? There are certain ways for you to still participate in the market, I imagine.
Yes.
You can't. Yes.
Yeah, so you can invest in collective investment vehicles. So mm-hmm. that's the way I've always invested. And I mean, even doing that, you have to, I think, be careful in terms of biases, because if you're taking a big bet on the direction of the market or part of the market, your commentary can be biased by it. So if I was heavily, you know, exposed to, let's say, India at the moment, I think, you know, I would be writing about India in a way which was biased. It would be either I'd be trying to overcompensate for what mm-hmm. I knew was, you know, my position, or I would be just kind of totally seduced by all the confirmation bias which comes, you know, once you set all those behavioral things in motion, and I would be kind of, you know, singing the praises of, you know, the Indian stock market and the, you know, in the leading stocks there far too much. So I view it as a very important balancing act that journalists you know, have to be aware of, really.
Do you think, speaking of balance, that writing about a frog, a mammoth, a dino, and the scariest monster in the world balances well the seriousness of the financial writing that you do as well?
I don't know. It certainly works for me. I did once try after the credit crunch. I did try and do a financial inspired picture book based on apple pie and rotting apples in the barrel. And I can tell you it was one of the most terrible stories I ever tried to work up. I was there with my publisher and he was quite excited about the idea because of, you know, anything that relates to current events may work. And both of us had to agree I'd utterly failed and it was hopeless.
But, you know, I think there's a lot of wisdom in all those tales that we tell kids. Because when you really think about the lessons in a lot of those stories are as relevant to kids as they are to adults. We just forget them. You know, stories of greed and envy and all the other ones that, you know, parables and tales and fables that we've read or heard as kids, they kind of repeat in the adult life, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the longer I've been writing about investing, the more I see it as boiling down to these very, you know, basic urges, which, you know, emotion overtakes intellect in almost all circumstances, unless you have a very clear structure in place to kind of, you know, jolt you back to, you know, the rational you and focus on what, you kind of know you should be doing intellectually rather than what you really hugely want to do. You know, emotionally. And I think, you know, and anyway, I mean, you know, just, you know, touching on my, you know, my own portfolios, we did a second ago, you know, one of the basis of how I manage it is through a rebalancing process. And rebalancing, you're essentially buying pain and, you know, selling the, you know, the good the stuff which has done well, which makes you feel good. And just doing something as simple as that, I find, you know, traumatic almost for the week after the rebalance has happened, even though intellectually I know this makes perfect sense. I'm, you know, I'm kicking myself and like feeling like a fool and everything, and then I kind of finally managed to forget it and, you know, everything gets back to normal. But yeah, so, you know, these kind of emotional urges are, you know, are everything really.
I like that phrase, buying pain. And I don't know if you said selling joy, but something along those lines. And it makes me think that a lot of professional what's the word that you used?
No. I think you expressed it better than me.
But I'm thinking of professional investors, how they do the opposite. Somehow they derive pleasure from finding a deal, a bargain, and it gets them excited that they see a stock that's down 50% that they wanted to buy anyway. And then I don't think they get sad when the stock goes up, but it makes them realize, oh, I could have bought more and I have a hard time buying more because it has gone up. I think there's a lot to unpack in there and I'm sure it will come up further in the conversation. But I want to ask you about the book, The Four Ways to Beat the Market. How did it come about? It's a wonderful book. It's a study of various screens, how you look up winning stocks. But tell me about the idea, where the inspiration came from and how did it come about?
So it's all based on a column I wrote over a decade for a British investment magazine, which is kind of FT owned, called The Investor's Chronicle, which is one of the leading investment magazines in the UK. And what happened was one day the editor wanted to have this stock screening column. So the idea wasn't even mine, and he kind of asked a few of the kind of lesser editors, I suppose, you know, associate editors or whatever we were, if, you know, every week someone would put it, you know, write, you know, put forward a screen idea which we could write up for the readers. Mm-hmm. And as I, you know, watched my colleagues wince around me, I was there kind of like rubbing my hands with glee, just absolutely, you know, I couldn't think of anything better. You know, early on in my career, I think one of the, you know, first books which I just marveled at was Jim O'Shaughnessy's What Works on Wall Street, which, you know, I was just, you know, yeah, no, it's a total classic. And I was just, you know, amazed by, you know, the depth of the study and just like, you know, that there seemed to be ways of, you know, finding good ideas by looking, you know, at the numbers. And I was just really excited about trying to implement the ideas that sat behind popular investment strategies, essentially, and seeing, you know, thinking them through and building screens which tried to emulate them, and were reasonably specific to certain styles of investing. And mm-hmm. so I did that, and I after 5 years, the column became really quite popular. And after 5 years, Harriman House, or someone at Harriman House called Craig Pierce, a really amazing editor there, who I think he's getting quite a lot of recognition because he edited Morgan Housel's book, The Psychology of Money, which has obviously done phenomenally well. But he approached me to say, you know, would you like to write a book on stock screening? I felt, you know, at that point, I felt I didn't really actually have very much to say. And I felt 5 years wasn't very long. I'd been following the performance of lots of all these screens, and a lot of them had done, very well. But after 10 years, I kind of went back to him and I kind of said, you know, I think actually, you know, there's 10 years worth of data. There's one crash in there now. And I think there's actually a story that's being told, and it's a story that I think I can tell and will be valuable. So that was how the book really came about, and then a lot of writing after that.
There's this beautiful quote early in your book that I highlighted, and really it spoke to me. You say, the lesson for investors is that to make the best possible judgments and decisions, it's vital to have a well-designed systematic process. That is something stock screens can give us when hunting for investment ideas. This is the reason why stock screens give investors an edge. Can you talk more about it? I found it really interesting because I feel like screens can make our life better. They can allow us to focus on the part of the market that's more appealing, more attractive. But I think most of all, it can allow us to filter out a lot of the noise that a lot of companies that I look at that I think are not investable from my perspective. And I've used screens over the years that I'll share more about as we speak. But tell me more about this idea of creating a process that allows the investor to focus.
So, I think with investing and with individual investment cases and with views on the market, is the information that investors have to deal with is kind of very, you know, it's very complicated. Very contradictory a lot of the time, and just, you know, it can be extremely confusing, and it's very easy to focus on one thing whilst ignoring a whole load of other stuff just so that you have a coherent story. And I don't think investing is coherent. It's that's why there's opportunity, because there are endless contradictions. But one thing we do know is, there are higher probabilities of finding good investments if we look for certain things. So, my book focuses on, the four really, best recognized styles or factors, whatever you want to call them, and kind of, takes it from there. But so I think a screen forces us to really, ask ourselves, what's our objective? Why do we think, if I'm going to look for a company which has these characteristics, why have I boosted my probability of finding a good investment? But once you've understood that, then you've got to create a really simple framework which focuses on the few things which really matter. So there are lots of things you could focus on when, as an investor, let's say we're talking about value. There are endless, characteristics you can focus on. And, some people use checklists, which are, have 50 points on them or whatever. Mm-hmm. But to make that kind of like initial universe of stocks, which are worth researching and worth, seeing if they tick all the boxes, you need something, really quite simple to be effective, which focuses on those really important things. So it's a case of deciding, what is really important? What does... what are the mechanics behind this, observable thing which goes on in the stock market, which, means that on average over time, value has outperformed since, obviously people have tested it, way back to whenever. And then also, once you've got that framework, continuing with the example of value, which has done really badly over, it's had a bit of a resurgence, but it did really badly for 15 years. It's far easier to just ask that simple question of, you know, what's going wrong? Has, you know, psychology changed? Which is seems very unlikely. You know, these, you know, dynamic which has worked for, you know, decades on decades on decades. It seems unlikely it's going to, you know, it's going to, you know, disappear all of a sudden. And then, you know, you can kind of go and look for your answers and hopefully amend your process if it needs amending, et cetera. But it's that thing of having a really clear, you know, you could call it a framework or process. I think it's hugely important. And also, I think, you know, there's quite a lot of work that's been done to demonstrate how much it improves decision making. To have a really good framework, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, there's the book Noise, which came out, which Daniel Kahneman et al. It kind of goes deeply into this idea of you know, simple processes in order to aid better decision making, and
having a structure in decision making. That book, and you share the story about evaluating, I think, candidates to join the army and people that had a checklist and a process, although at the end they made up their mind based on qualitative experience with the candidate. And I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. You correct me if I'm wrong. But
yeah, well, this is a great story, which is told in Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, and also Noise. Daniel Kahneman, when he was in drafted into the Israeli Defense Force, when he was like really, you know, very young, you know, very green behind the ears, and he had to improve recruiting, and what he found was to, you know, focus, I think it was five different factors, just to get recruiters to focus on five different factors massively and score them individually, massively improved the process. But the surprise bit for him was he, because they all kind of hated being made into robots as they saw it. and so they rebelled, and they were like, you know, what does this, you know, pipsqueak, you know about anything? Why is he telling us how to do things? And so he introduced a test where, they gave a holistic view on the candidate. And he found after, this was useless beforehand, before he introduced his process. Right. The holistic tape was useless. But after they had to consider these five different points and then gave their holistic view, the holistic test became, I think, the most informative out of all the indicators that they had for each candidate. So it just shows, structuring your thoughts through process is potentially incredibly powerful.
So before we start talking about the four ways to beat the market, I want to ask you about financial statements. And early in your book, you introduced the reader to what they are. And usually when people hear those two words, financial statements, they somehow run and leave the room. And but you approach the topic. That's a difficult topic. They're not very intuitive ideas in a way that really spoke to me. And I've been in the business investing money for 20 years, and I have moments when I sit down and I explain financial statements to individuals, interns, and people that are curious. But tell me about your way of looking at financial statements, kind of a 3-minute version. What are they? What are the three, and how they talk to each other, and some of the stories they can tell us?
No, absolutely. Well, also I should say in the book, it's I say, basically, financial statements, it just boils down to one very simple idea, which is matching. Mm-hmm. And that is matching what you estimate your sales to be in the year to what you estimate the cost of those sales to be. And I think, you know, it took me, two decades of kind of, trying to understand financial statements to understand how simple the main idea was. And it was thanks to an accounting professor, an amazing accounting professor called Barrett Lev, who I was lucky enough to interview, who just kind of said, you know, he was talking about intangibles, but he introduced it by talking about the matching exercise. And I felt, you know, it often does take, you know, me at least, two decades to understand something very simple, but the penny dropped and it's like, oh yes, it's so easy, the whole concept. But yeah, no, so of course, you know, one of the things in the book which I try and point out is that, you know, just keep, you know when you're going through financial statements, always bear it in mind that, you know, this is, you know, what it's trying to do is something really simple, and if you stick with that simple idea, it'll make the whole thing so much easier to understand. But of course, I mean, the problem is that sales are often hard to estimate for a company because they, you know, right, they multi-year contracts or, you know, what have you. I mean, there's a UK company called Rolls-Royce, which obviously, you know, once upon a time it sold the Rolls-Royce car, but it sells aeroplane engines mainly. And its accounts are amazing because it sells its engines at a loss so that in the future it can have it can maintain them, and it gets paid well for the maintenance and makes a nice profit on the maintenance. So when it makes a sale, it's having to try and estimate the value of that maintenance in the future in order to calculate the value of the sale today. I don't actually know if it's changed its accounting policies recently, but you know, this is an incredibly, you know, difficult thing to do, and also then to marry that with costs further down the line. So you have this estimation process which is trying to give a, you know, fair and true assessment of the value of sales today, but it's going to bear no resemblance to the cash flow statement. And also, because the future is unpredictable, it's likely to bear no resemblance to, you know, what actually happens either. So, I have a lot of sympathy for, you know, finance directors, because, you know, often they have these business models which they're, you know, trying to present in, you know, in a income statement, you know, as sales and as costs. And, you know, the estimating task they're asked to do is just, you know, is crazy. So, you know, for the investor, you have to understand that. You have to understand what sales actually consist of, and also what cost is as well, because, you know, often, you know, you retailers, for example, they can have, you know, huge costs which are, you know, on the balance sheet rather than through the profit and loss account, because it's stock, they're investing in stock, and they haven't made the sales related to it yet, but that, you know, that's a kind of cost which, you know, could hit in a really nasty way in the future, for example. But so you have to understand what everything is in these statements and how the statements marry together, because you have the profit and loss, which is, you know, this kind of narrative, I suppose, that the finance department's telling about, you know, what they think is going on with the business. And it's, you know, and you know, it should be honest and fair, but that doesn't mean it's not going to be wrong. Then you have the cash flow, which is, you know, the actual nuts and bolts cash reality. But this also can be very deceptive, because sometimes you'll have a big cash payment or big cash expense in, you know, in 1 year, and then not in the next. So that can be very lumpy and volatile. And then you have the balance sheet, which is where kind of, you know, everything else is, you know, really parked, whilst you've got this, you know, matching exercise going on. These are all the, you know, these are all the chips put over here for going through the profit and loss later on. But so, yeah, no, I mean, I think accounts are, you know, they're very simple in terms of what they're trying to do. Conceptually, you can go through, you know, the lines and understand them simply. But then when it comes to understanding them in light of the business, that's where the kind of, you know, confusion and complication comes in. So the importance of knowing the simple ideas is paramount for me, I think.
But if you look at years and years of financial statements, they can tell you a story, how the business is really doing. Yeah. And I think the longer the period, the less you can hide. I think that would be the word to use here, or at least, you know, deceive willingly or unwillingly, and that's for everybody to judge. But I think Absolutely. If you have 5 or 10 years, things just start to show up, and you realize they show a profit, but the cash flows remain small or negative, or something is accumulating on the balance sheet, whether it's additional borrowing or you mentioned stock inventory that's piling up and not selling. So there are things that you can see and notice, and I'm sure we'll come back to it. I think we're living in an era where when I look at earnings, companies report adjusted earnings excluding restructuring and all kinds of new terms. And it almost feels like a student that says that I got an A if I excluded all my mistakes. Well, that's not very helpful. But it's something to keep in mind if you have a company that continuously reports adjusted earnings excluding restructuring. You have to assume that some of those things are not one-off items. They are permanent part of the picture.
Yeah.
So let's jump in and talk about some of the screens. The first one is quality. Mm-hmm. And you write, many excellent investment opportunities are often undervalued and hidden in plain sight. Tell me about those quality stocks that you screen for in your first screen. What are they?
So these are stocks which essentially just make a very high return on capital. And mm-hmm. It's the idea of compounding, really, which is at the heart of this screen. So if a company can make a very high return on capital, then it's worth it in investing money back into its own business, because you get the kind of snowball effect of wealth generation happening inside a company. And it's always most efficient if you're thinking about compounding. It's always most efficient for compounding to happen inside a company's own operations. And obviously, it's the story behind some of the, biggest successes, which we all know about, whether it be Coca-Cola or, Berkshire Hathaway or Amazon. I think the hidden in plain sight bit, in my book, I try and relate everything to you kind of behavioral investing ideas, or the kind of biases we have when we look at the world. And you would have thought if a company is producing very high returns on capital, people should be all over it and valuing it in. And I mean, sometimes that is the case, and normally high quality companies do have very high valuations compared with other companies. But I think there's a real problem for people to really appreciate the kind of upward sloping curves which are caused by compounding. Because you're talking about, growth, which happens then on top of growth. And then, that growth builds the next level to grow from. Generally, most of us think in straight lines. Mm-hmm. So when we think of growth, it's kind of, it's not growth on top of growth on top of growth. It's just growth from the same bases we're at now every year. And so I think there's almost mistrust in the idea that this can actually happen. So you have companies which produce very high returns on capital consistently, which may look expensive compared to peers, but actually can prove huge bargains over the long term if they're able to, if their moat or their competitive advantage or whatever you want to call it actually persists, and the growth opportunity persists. So it's a very interesting area, and it's also the area where you essentially want all your investments to end up, because this is it's the kind of Warren Buffett territory where you buy and hold forever. Ideally though, you want to buy a company which looks attractive for on the basis of value or something like that, and then for it to reinvent itself as a compounder, which is where the stock market's biggest returns probably are. But you can make extremely good returns historically from just buying really good quality stocks. But obviously you have to make sure you're not being deceived and buying a story or buying a company which is a compounder at the moment, but actually there's something threatening its competitive position or threatening the growth rate, and it's actually going to start maturing and becoming something else.
I like the idea of a life of a company, and it's something that's not, I think, appreciated enough, that companies are like any animal out there. they have a certain life, and there's the growth stage, the maturing stage, and a certain stage where it's reached its peak. The returns that it's been getting on the capital will never go higher. And many companies in that position go after acquisitions, go after lesser businesses, and eventually the returns start to decline. So you have to be very aware, and it's easier said than done. Where is this company on its own trajectory? And second thing that I was... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think the corporate life cycle is, absolutely fascinating. And there's, you know, there's a really thorough and underappreciated framework for analyzing it out there, which I don't know if it's going to start getting attention now. I think there's a book that I've seen coming out by Ashwath Damodaran. Next year, which is, and he's written a lot about the corporate life cycle, but it's just this great framework for, yes, you know, as exactly as you say, understanding, you know, where a company is. And I think also the amazing thing about the corporate life cycle is that you know, companies can go back in time, so there's reverse aging that happens, which is you know, which can just be phenomenal for investors. So you can analyze whether capital's being allocated sensibly based on this life cycle framework. But B, the, you know, the real trick, and I think it's probably, you know it's very hard really, is to find that company which is going from a kind of mature stage and it's circling back to the compounding stage, because it's kind of unlocking some kind of hidden value in its business, or a value which has hitherto been underappreciated by management.
It's an opportunity to reinvent itself, which is not that easy. And I haven't seen too many examples, but it has happened that companies have reinvented themselves and have yet one more life and one more life, which doesn't apply in nature. you can't, depends on your set of beliefs, but you know,
yes.
There's one lifetime, let's say, but if there are more, I'll take them. But I wanted to mention Munger, because Munger made an interesting point that even if you buy a stock, and it leads me to the next screen that you have, contrarian value. So if you buy a stock that's quality, but you buy it when it's undervalued, eventually it becomes fully valued or even overvalued. In the long run, past all the cycles, when you talk about compounders, it's the rate of return on capital that will define what kind of returns you can get on the investment. And I think it's interesting to remember. But I think you pointed out something else that was really interesting to a broader audience, this quality approach. I think it's too simple, too obvious, and not exciting enough. And I think that's why it's not as widely adopted, because it's all about picking the right stocks, just like Buffett did and quite a few other people, and sitting on them, letting them be, letting them grow, letting them perform. And it's the hardest thing to do. And you said something else, that eventually most of your investments, if I heard you correctly, will be in those stocks. So if you have this kind of coffee can approach, and I don't know if you're familiar, I'm guessing you are, with Robert Kirby and his article about a coffee can portfolio. You are? Or?
Yes, I am.
Yes, of course. But for the audience, for the benefit of the audience, the idea is to, you know, very simply to buy and never sell. And the portfolio at the end of the day, and Robert Kirby gives an example of a particular client, will look really strange, because you will have stocks that are, you know, 25% of the portfolio, and you will have many that are 0.5% of the portfolio, but you let your winners run. And you will realize that the majority of the wealth of the portfolio, the financial capital, ends up being in a handful of stocks actually belong to this category of, you know, quality businesses. That's what ends up happening, which is, you know, fascinating to think about.
It is. I mean, also I should say when I was saying about businesses ending up as in this quality basket, I was saying it as an ideal. I don't because some of the I think you know, some of the other strategies in the book, it may be just that, you know, that quick, you know, that short-term investment rather than them ending up as a quality company. But I mean, ideally, that's where you want everything to end up, because, you know, exactly as you just said, is, you know, it's those businesses which can compound over time, which those are the ones which are most likely to change someone's wealth over their lifetime.
Well, eventually they will outlast everybody else. I wrote an article, a stock for a grandchild, and it was inspired by a question the client asked. Jokingly, but not so jokingly, if we were to pick one single stock for a grandchild, kind of a play on a very long-term investment horizon, you know, 20-some years.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, it creates an amazing filter of what kind of stocks would you consider, right? So you would exclude the ones, we're talking about the life cycle, you would exclude the ones that are very mature, that are paying dividends, that are not growing as much, that are focusing on financial engineering, buybacks, dividends, but they have less of an opportunity to grow. You would also exclude the ones that have not proven yet that they can make money. Their unit economics mm-hmm. have not been figured out. They're probably still losing money. So you would narrow down your universe to companies that have already some serious margins and profits. They're publicly traded, if that's the market you operate in. And they have enough history for you to realize that it seems to work, whatever they're doing, but they also deserve a 20-year investment horizon. And that's a very interesting way of looking at it. And it overlaps with quite a few of the screens that you propose.
Yeah. No, it does. Yeah.
I want to ask you about contrarian value investing. It resonates yes. with me as speaking of my personality. I like to go places where people are afraid to go or they got burned. And I think it creates that initial opportunity that Munger talks about, that you get a discount. But then a lot of those stocks end up hopefully in the category that I would call quality. It makes sense to hold them for the long run. But let's focus just on the contrarian value investing screen that you have. Tell me more how it works, when it works, and what's it all about.
So the contrarian value investing screen is really all about reversion to the mean, or that's the kind of main idea that sits behind it. And reversion to the mean, it's a kind of phenomenon that we see on the stock market, but also, you know, widely in nature and many other things, where when you have things moving to one extreme, they tend back towards the average over time. And what the screen's trying to find is companies which have hit a bad spell, and people being people, you know, when a company's doing badly, we find it very hard to imagine that it will return to form. You know, often it's to do, you know, problems are to do with, you know, something that's happened internally or can be external in the industry. But the idea is to find these companies when everyone's given up on them, and buying in the hope that things will improve. And when things do improve in those situations, you get not only the stock re-rating against its fundamentals, but also the fundamentals themselves improving. So you can have huge gains if you pick contrarian stocks well. But it's also a very risky form of investment, because when you're thinking about this idea of reversion to the mean in the stock market and with companies, sometimes the mean, that kind of average steady state for a company, changes, you know, permanently for the worst. So, you know, when companies are disrupted, for example, often their businesses are never going to recapture the highs that they once experienced. So you can end up buying what's colloquially known as a value trap. So you buy something cheap and it just keeps on getting cheaper in with, you know, those kind of airmark speech marks.
It's a tricky territory. It's very appealing to some people. And I think what you point out in your book as well is that it works in certain periods of time, and then it just fails to deliver in other years. And I think that's the trying part of being a true contrarian value investor. Yeah. And also, in my mind, it's a range of how deep of a value investor you want to be. You can go all the way back to the traditional Ben Graham approach, when you just look at the balance sheet and it's a statistical approach of buying a business for, you know, less than the cash and the inventory and on the balance sheet, all the way to finding a more nuanced way of looking at valuations and finding a discount even in businesses that have more intangible assets. I think the philosophy can evolve. The one thing I'd like to mention, I see myself as a value buyer and a growth holder, if I was to label myself, because I find it appealing to buy when there's a discount for whatever reason, short-lived, driven by some behavioral elements here of people panicking or getting too fearful about a short-lived problem. But it gives me an advantage that I can buy something and then hold it and kind of becomes more of a quality holding down the road. That would be an ideal path. I find it very intriguing that the other screen that you have, the dividend stock screen, on one hand, you present this story of, I think it was an academic that researched dividend stocks and then went to the actual investment world and had a hard time selling that kind of idea. But tell me more about it. And I think it's a theme in investing that a lot of things that seem very, they make sense when they're on paper, but in real life, with real investors, with real emotions, they're much harder to actually first deliver on and second to actually sell.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think, the academic turned professional is, yes, no, it's a really interesting one. I mean, I think with most, strategies, which, give you a chance of outperformance, there's some kind of contradiction there. A contradiction has to exist, which makes them hard to understand and underappreciated. But with dividend investing, it's particularly interesting because it's an unpalatable strategy to the investment industry, because it tends to perform very smoothly. And what that means is that whilst you don't, or historically, it hasn't suffered very badly when the market's been falling a lot, it doesn't do that great when the market's really tearing away and when you're, as a professional firm, you're in real asset gathering mode. So trying to sell people on the idea that basically accept the fact you can't market time. When the stock market goes down, this strategy is going to lose you money, but not as much as everyone else. And you're never going to be able to brag to your mates. It's a very hard pitch. And I think the people who have tried to implement this strategy, their biggest fear is career risk. The fact that, even though they may have a totally viable and sensible strategy to propose, people are just going to get fed up with it when everything's excited, and then underappreciated, or be too late by the time the market's tanked. You know, you can't launch a new fund in time to really capture that sweet spot for the strategy. But it's also very interesting in terms of the psychology of investors, because essentially the dividend strategy, which kind of seems to work in terms of all the back testing, is buying these very boring, conservatively run companies who don't want to allocate capital to growth, and they want, they don't want to take the risk. They just, they're going to hand it back to shareholders, and they have low volatility in their share prices, as well as good dividend records and decent yields. And people just don't like boring stocks, which is, we don't like boring
mind.
Things. If you know the secret, they're delightful. But for most of us, it's it's like that joy of buying a lottery ticket. It's your chances of winning are next to zero, and the mass doesn't make sense, but it's thrilling nevertheless. It's like the idea of being a millionaire and after a draw which lasts 5 minutes is just so tantalizing to everyone. The same thing plays out in the stock market, and it's been measured by many people. I think it's called skewedness, the phenomenon that people look at. But we just love these returns that could be asymmetric, to the extent that we don't evaluate the risk correctly. We'll buy something into a hugely risky proposition for the chance, a very slim chance of a massive return. And, you know, lo and behold, you end up as a loser doing that. But on the other end of the scale, buy boring and you'll probably do really pretty well.
That's a good tagline, buy boring. I like that. But you point out a couple of fascinating things. First one, it seems that most of the assets joined the market at the wrong time. We seem to, as a crowd, we seem to zigzag the wrong way. And it's related to what you just mentioned. When people see, and I call it the neighbor getting richer than you, faster than you, moment where you just can't wait. You can't sit it out. You have to be a part of this fast rising market. And that's when most of the assets come in. And dividend strategy is one of the strategies that just, they don't work in this kind of a market. It's the short-lived ideas and strategies that we'll talk about in a second when we talk about momentum that work really well.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I wanted to mention, that sometimes the best ideas, they're the hardest to implement in the investment world. They're just very uncomfortable. And if you can get over that discomfort, that's when the magic happens. But let's talk about momentum, because momentum, as humans, we like to follow the crowd. I actually wrote a book, Outsmarting the Crowd, so I have some thoughts about it. But
yes.
In general, I feel like there are moments when it really pays to listen to the crowd. The crowd has its wisdom. But you share this story in the book that I'll let you maybe share it with us, how there are moments when it's not a good idea to follow the crowd. With momentum investing, you follow the crowd, you actually do well until you don't. Can you talk about that?
I think in the book, I don't know if it's a story that you're necessarily referring to, but I mean, before getting onto that, I think, you know, this is in terms of talking about contradictions, as mentioning in relation to dividend investing. I mean, with momentum, the contradiction is brilliant because of the names we have for the two forces at work. And one is the wisdom of crowds,
right.
And the other is the madness of crowds, which is, when people just get totally carried away, and both are at work together at the same time, all the time.
And they do.
and it's just, you know, it's lots of fun. and occasionally disastrous. But I suppose the place to start actually is just to understand the wisdom of crowds, because for the wisdom of crowds to work, judgments being made by the individuals who are part of the crowds. And the idea is that, you know, the collective, the average of the judgments is better than any one individual judgment from the crowd. And it can be, you know, it works again and again, but the judgments have to be independent. Mm-hmm. And in the stock market, of course, we can all see share prices. We can all see how share prices are moving. We know because of the wisdom of crowd that carries a huge amount of really valuable information for us that we should be paying attention to. But that corrupts the independence of our judgments. So
yes.
we're using the wisdom of crowds in a completely imperfect circumstances. And I suppose one of the stories in the book which I use is this like great experiment that some researchers did on music downloads, where they tested people's preferences for music when people were allowed to submit ratings for the music and weren't, and then in another environment where they weren't. And they found as soon as people were allowed to, as soon as social influence came in, these kind of reviews, which are either five stars or whatever. And they slightly jigged it. So they kind of like gave, you know, they experimented with giving certain tracks, higher reviews to start with. But it completely corrupted the decision-making process. And what was really interesting was that, you know, you something really good never was rated really bad, and something really bad never got really good, but kind of everything in the middle, you know, is all to play for, essentially. And I think, you know, with the stock market, there's a lot of that at work all the time. But I suppose actually the extremes of the madness of crowds is, you know, the story stocks that we kind of saw getting great acclaim during 2021. And And then, you know, you can have something totally insubstantial, although you can also, you know, there will inevitably also be, you know, very clever people offering very clever explanations why as to why, you know, these stocks actually are very valuable, even if they're not making a profit. And even if, you know, the economics of the business don't seem to stack up, but we're very good at convincing ourselves and each other that, you know, what we want to be true is true.
You raise a fascinating point that we can trust what the crowd tells us, assuming that everybody in that crowd has an independent voice, not influenced by whoever is standing next to them. And there's the story of an ox weighing competition in a big square.
Oh, yes.
Right? Everybody guesses how much the bull, the ox weighs. And then because they vote, they cast a vote in an independent way, actually, as a crowd, it's a pretty accurate estimate of the weight. But the stock market doesn't work that way, because we start to look over our shoulder and see what the other person is doing. They seem to be buying, so maybe I should be buying. And eventually you outsource, you surrender your own thinking to everybody around you. And in that moment, the whole independence is gone. And it's really a one voice. And if the voice is in that particular moment wrong about the situation, you're going to end up on the wrong side of the bull market again. Funny.
Absolutely. Very good. Yes.
Maybe there's some bull in the story. But anyways, it's important to remember how it's done, because you're trying to guess what your neighbor would do, or what the other participant in the market would do. You completely surrender and think, what I would do would make sense to me. You start to guess, and it can be many degrees away. You're trying to guess what other people are guessing about the market. It's a loser's game at the end of the day, and it's a hard realization that it's a different crowd we're dealing with.
Go ahead. No, I mean, I was going to say, I think, you know, with momentum, and I think this is a point that I make with them. But it is a point I make about all the screens, is you've got to get down to the brass tacks at the end of the day. You have to actually research the stocks to find out whether there is substance there, because often something can look good on a few metrics, even if they're, you know, the best chosen metrics out there. And but, you know, without really kicking the tires, you just won't know whether it's it really stands up or not.
I think that the most powerful thing about screens, and I've used them over the last 20 years in various ways, is that it allows me to focus on the part of the market that I should consider. And that saves a lot of time. I can really spend more time on fewer names, fewer stocks that make sense to me. And then being aware of where we are, both in the life cycle of a business, but also in a cycle of a market, where you are. And different approaches will work differently, and being aware
Absolutely.
Of it. And before I ask you about some red flags when it comes to investing, when we talk about an approach or a screen working, we've been talking about our performance and the way you run those screens, you compare them to an index and so on. But for a second, just to entertain me, when you think about investing as a way of compounding wealth over a lifetime or many generations, as it is for the clients that I work with, then if you forget the index for a second, which, by the way, is a human-made invention, people forget that. It's not God-given. It's actually managed and created by people. If there was no index, there was no benchmark, right, for a second, and your goal was to independently, from everything else, your neighbor and the market as such, you wanted to compound your wealth at whatever rate you think is reasonable, sustainable over the long run, without you risking, and I want to emphasize it, without risking all that you have. And whether it's 5% or 15%, I will tell you it's not 75% year after year, if some people think it's the case. It's just, you know, physically impossible to do it year after year. But there is some sort of a rate that you're comfortable with. And if you find an approach that's a mix of a screen, a system, and some in-depth research, and if that kind of approach, you know, it gives you some comfort that can deliver sustainable, but not linear and not equal each year, but some sustainable rate of return, then to me, that's already a success. You'll get to where you're going. Now, if you invite the index to the conversation, you start comparing yourself, there will be years where your sensible approach will look not so great relative to the index, because the index can consist of, you know, hundreds of stocks, but maybe seven stocks dominate where the market is moving, like it is today when we're talking, yep, you know, late in 2023. And in those moments, it's a very hard frenemy, that I would call it, you know, and not a true friend and not an actual enemy, but a frenemy a bit, that the benchmark can become to your investment process. You're paying attention to something that can be distracting, but I'll just throw it in there. I don't know if you have some comments on that.
No, I mean, I think that's, you know, entirely true. And I, you know, it's kind of measuring performance against an index is useful because it kind of gives us an indication of whether the approach that we're looking at is useful more than anything else. But yeah, no, I think, you know, the trouble is for us, you know, what's true is what's happening in the moment right now. It's very hard to separate ourselves from that and, you know, understand that, you know, probably the, you know, the long game is, you know, the one that we thought it was and what happened in the past, and rather than the long game being what's happening right now in this second. And, you know, if you're, you know, having a painful experience in terms of your investments, then you know, that, you know, what's true is that you're, you know, a terrible investor and your returns are terrible forever. Mm-hmm. And so looking at it, comparing to an index can compound that, just as, you know, paying too much attention to your portfolio can compound that. So, I think, you know, indexes, you know, they're useful for long-term measures in terms of looking at history and evaluating, the validity of approaches. But, they're not, one's friend in terms of, you know, the psychology of investing. I think I totally agree with you.
Well, because people try to look at them as some great point of reference. And I'm thinking for a second, imagine that humanity has never invented an index. Dow Jones, I don't know, picked up a different profession. Imagine, how would you be investing today if there was no index to look at, right? And you would really go back to the essence, what you're trying to do, which is grow your wealth over time without risking losing it. Mm-hmm. And it would be a more focused, in my mind, you know, philosophy. So looking at the index, I know they exist and there are ways to invest in them in index funds, and that's great. And I think it works very well for in certain circumstances, that's for sure. But just thinking about it for a second, how would you make your investment decisions without an index if it didn't exist? And I think it would bring up a lot of other essential questions about what it really means to you to participate in the stock market as, you know, ownership of a collection of businesses. I want to ask you, and I'm going to use the term from your kids' books, the scary monsters, which are the red flags in investing. So what are the scary monsters that you found doing your research? Because you sprinkled them like raisins in your book here and there, about profits, cash flow, balance sheet, and we touched on it briefly, but if you can mention, you know, a couple of red flags that people should watch out once they're actually looking at the fundamentals of the business. And I think you mentioned Thomas Cook somewhere in there as well.
Oh yeah, I think Thomas Cook actually is, I try and highlight a success and a disaster from each screen to help readers kind of understand the, you know, process of actually researching stocks and trying to avoid the duds. But I think that, yeah, there are a few red flags which I highlight in the book, because I just think they're extremely useful and extremely simple. And they don't require you to be a forensic accountant to spot them. They may require you to be a forensic accountant to kind of fully investigate them. But definitely, you know, if there's a red flag, you want to either understand why it's not a problem or just kind of, you know, give a company a wide berth, I think, normally. Mm-hmm. So I think adjustments to profits, as we kind of touched on earlier, if a company persistently adjusts its profits, then, you know, is always a very long way away. I mean, there are some, you know, accounting oddities around acquisitions, which mean certain adjustments are totally legitimate. But if it's what people call exceptional items around restructuring, etc., then you want to definitely pay attention to that and, you know, be scared. Then there are also, there's also the issue of whether cash flow over the long term marries up to profits. So I kind of think, you know, if you take 5 years of cash flows and compare it with 5 years of the of an equivalent line in the profit and loss statement, and if it's very far off, you'll want to know why. Also, you know, normally the kind of cash conversion level, which is about right, is around 80% for most cash flow measures, rather than 100%, which is kind of worth bearing in mind also. And then there are lots of very useful balance sheet ratios, which tell you what's going on with the company's working capital, and which are really useful to investors. So generally, it's you know, you can compare them to, you know, a few things, but generally, if you just compare to sales, it's it works. So looking at stock compared to sales, and debtors, which is money owed in the short term compared to sales, and also the money owed by the company to its suppliers in the short term, so payables compared with sales, and looking at trends in that relationship over time. And you can quite easily spot when something just looks a bit, you know, off with those ratios. And it's surprising how often it does actually, you know, alert you to a future problem. So, you know, kind of just being conscious of those ways of interrogating accounts to check whether profits really are profits. I think, you know, really helpful, and something which don't, you know, we talk about, you know, ratios to do with valuation a lot, but and to do with quality, but ratios do with, you know, the integrity of reported numbers. I think you know, people could talk about a lot more and pay a lot more attention to generally.
It's interesting what you mentioned, how you don't have to be a forensic accountant to pick up on certain things. And it's really interesting, because when you get a bit comfortable with the financial statements, you start to notice things that just don't add up, don't make sense. And you don't have to go very, very deep and find exactly what's wrong. I think what may happen, I've seen it happen, that there is an issue that arises and the story is just too good to be true and things don't add up. And a few years down the road, the company restates the statements, and sometimes the management gets fired. And then we find out, oh, that's what they were doing. And then it takes years to figure out what they were booking in an incorrect way and misleading the audience here. But if you find something that doesn't make sense and looks kind of like a scary monster, yeah, you don't have to go and open the branches and look through the bushes to see the face of that monster. That's how I look at it.
Quite. You stay away.
Exactly. I think that's the biggest lesson for me. You don't have to prove to yourself that this was a scary monster. You kind of saw it. You kind of smelled it. I think it's time to go the other way. I think that's what saved us as, you know, humans through millions of years of us being on this planet. And I think once we end up in the investment world, we forget it. If it sounds and smells like a scary monster, go the other way. I think that's the lesson. Combining your two writing experiences in one, if you allow me.
Beautifully done.
I have one last question for you. I like to ask my guests about their definition of success. How do you think about success?
Oh God, this is such a good question, I think, because it's I mean, it's so, you know, it's one of those things. I think we all want to be successful, and we all kind of, because we want it, we kind of have this feeling that we know what it means for us. And I found in my life, I definitely don't really know what it means, because I've kind of found in my own life and personal experience that probably, you know, the kind of tangible accolades that I'm chasing, often when, you know, I attain them, they kind of lose all value. I just want the next thing, and I kind of, you know, I chastise myself for this kind of, you know, for these kind of feelings, because kind of, you know, it's obviously, it's like totally self-defeating. I do think, you know, in some way there's some things which, you know, I feel like for me, I've got right, and you know, pursuing this, you know, pursuing kind of, you know, my picture book dreams, or whatever you'd like to call it. You know, having picture books published has always been a, you know, a hugely fulfilling thing for me. And you know, following my interests in financial journalism has also always been hugely fulfilling. And that's not to do with necessarily the end point, but it's to do with just enjoying, what I'm up to and following my interests. So I think probably, for me to be successful, it's more about, remembering to do that, remembering to come, enjoy what I'm doing, make sure that I'm doing the stuff I enjoy, and also appreciating, what I actually have. And, if that's, why I am, however much later in life, I think, that's probably going to be what really, on a personal level is going to define success for me. And, I can say these lofty things, and I should point out that probably I'm a huge failure at actually achieving them most of the time in my life. But I think, if I was to try and give an honest answer, that would be it, because there are lots of kind of, ambition, that I have, and things which I'd like to achieve, which I just know, will kind of actually in reality not have that much real value to me once it happens. So those things are good, I think, because they keep you going, but their genuine importance is not so much.
No, I think it's beautifully put. It sounds like a journey, and you have a reason to get out of bed every day. There's something that you're excited about, and there's a lot of creative process in the work that you do. And you're sharing some, beautiful, fascinating ideas between the scary monsters in the real world and in the kids' imagination, and in both. And I think there are huge parallels. And I think, as serious as investing can be, I think we all can pick up a kid's book now and then and realize, I think those books are about us.
The good ones, yes.
The good ones are. But one last thing I wanted to mention, and you brought up Morgan Housel. He just came out with a book, Same As Ever, which is a wonderful read. I don't know if you got started on it, but one of the stories he shares somewhere in his writing that just popped in my head as you were saying, once you reach something, it's not as attractive anymore. And he makes a point somewhere, and I'm just paraphrasing here, how the first paycheck that you got, the first £100, dollars, euro, whatever it is, that you got paid, that made a bigger impact on your life at the time. It was life-changing. You finally could fill up the fridge, or pay off the last bill or whatever it is, much more than the 10,000 or the 100,000 or the million or whatever it is that comes down the road. And I thought it was such a powerful idea in terms of, we were talking a lot about investing and building wealth, how the value that the money gives us, it's not all the same. Each $100 is not equal. It depends on the context, when we receive it, how we receive it, and what kind of a life-changing experience it can be. Yeah. I like to think of, giving money meaning. And in the context of investing money for other people, I'm always fascinated with how does this money make a difference in their life? And you started with a story of your family and multi-generational wealth. And that's the experience I've had working with a lot of families. What can we do to secure their future, and how that money can provide, options, choices, freedom for the next generation? And it's a fascinating journey. And I think it shaped you. My experience growing up in Poland shaped me in many ways. And in my later work, I just look back and see how I make certain decisions when it comes to risk and reward in the world of investing, based on experiences that happened to me when I was reading about the scary monsters. What a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's been a huge pleasure for me. Thank you.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seacard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seacard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.